Welcome to the Commonwealth Club. I'm George Hammond, and this is part of the Monday Night Philosophy Series here at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco. We welcome our radio and our online audiences. And tonight, I'll be speaking about love, a rational explanation. A lot of people think there is no such thing as a rational explanation for love. It's chaotic. There's no such thing as being able to explain this experience that we all have. And of course, a lot of people have believed that for a very long time. And I'm hoping by the end of the lecture tonight that a few of you will agree with me that there actually might be a rational explanation for love. So we'll see. Now, what are my credentials for speaking about this? So I thought I'd give you a little idea about my credentials for this. And, you know, there's a large number of forms of love, and I'm trying to explain all forms of love, but I know that you're here to hear about romantic love as opposed to platonic love, for example. If I said it was going to be a lecture on platonic love, I'd probably have three people in the audience. Romantic love, my credentials are at the height of my experience as a romanticist, I once printed a list out of all of my girlfriends. There were 26 girls on the list. And I know that I printed them rather than wrote them out because it was in October of 1958 that I did this. When I was in kindergarten. That's when I peaked romantically. I had 26 girlfriends in kindergarten. I believe that it was probably every single girl in my class. But the basic experience that I had there is not that much different. I had a good friend, and I had one girl out of those 26 girls that I was most fond of. And one day in October, on a Monday morning, I still remember it was Monday. You'll see why. The teacher said, Mary here is learning ballet. She'd like to show everybody some ballet turns. So Mary got up in front of everybody and she did a few ballet turns. And then the teacher said something that, you know, really got me, which was, does anybody else have any dancing skills? And I thought, geez, if I had some dancing skills, Mary would be really impressed. But I don't take any lessons. But it was Monday morning, and Sunday night, I had just watched the Ed Sullivan Show, and somebody had tap danced on the Ed Sullivan Show, and so I thought to myself, I can fake that. So I said, I take tap dance lessons, and I got up in front of everybody, and I tap danced. I will not entertain you with how my tap dancing looked, but I got up in front of everybody, I tap danced, then the teacher kind of looked at me funny and said, thank you very much, George. I have a feeling she saw right through me, but that didn't matter because Mary didn't. Mary didn't see through me, and we had a play date fairly shortly after that. They didn't call them play dates back then. But the interesting thing about this experience is it is very similar in another way. I had a good friend, a male friend at the time, and about that after, you know, later that day or the next day or pretty soon thereafter, we were out, you know, competing on the monkey bars. Seeing how fast you could go across the monkey bars. They still call them monkey bars? I'm not sure. But in any case, he was a little smaller than I was, and he only got about halfway over before he dropped down. And then I got all the way over, and Mary made the big mistake of clapping for me. Apparently he liked Mary too, because a little bit later we were standing on a ledge, and he shoved me off the ledge. So I got my first experience of jealousy just a couple days after my first experience of tap dancing. So those are my credentials. After that, for romantic love, it was all downhill after that. But from the time I was 14 until into my 20s, I got very interested in trying to understand the patterns of things. And when I was 14, I read Plato's theory. One of the things that I really liked about it was it said that if you get the first principles straight, everything else will fall into place. That's in the Republic. And I thought, it's a great line, great line. I'm going to have to pay attention to that. So I paid attention to that over the years. And in my early 20s, I was trying to put together the pieces of information from all the different religions and philosophies. And, you know, I was reading everything, and I was teaching in Indian philosophy at the time. And I was thinking to myself, there's got to be a way to sort this mess out. Because, I mean, there's a lot of people thought that, of course, it's all, maybe some of you have heard the analogy, that it's all stories about an elephant, and somebody's describing the trunk, and somebody's describing the tail, and someone's got the leg, and so on, but no one's got the whole thing. And that's what I went into the possibility on that basis. But I found out a little bit later, at least I thought a little bit later, I came to the conclusion that it wasn't true at all, that people really were describing different things, and how can I sort through what's useful in what they said and what's not useful in what they said? Well, I won't go into all the detail or we'd be here forever, but one of the things that I figured out was that people, all the top thinkers, had their own personal agendas for their own self, for their own person, in addition to trying to be as objective as possible, they had personal drives that were making things unclear for them and for others when they tried to hear what they had to say. And I came up with an image of why that was. If you take human personality over the thousands of years and divide it into a bell curve, a bell curve distribution of human personality. And at one end over here are the psychopaths and the serial killers and all the people who have no feeling at all for other people, basically. I'll explain them a little bit more in detail later. And in the middle is, the vast bulk of the people. And at this end are maybe the top religious leaders and the philosophers and the top writers and some artists and, people who are way off the end on creativity and intelligence, scientists. So what was interesting to me when I looked at it that way was I said, what do the psychopaths and the serial killers say about humanity? They say they're all too good for their own good. They say it's a dog-eat-dog world, and these people don't understand that they shouldn't be so kind to each other because they shouldn't trust anybody. Even if you're kind to someone, they will eventually cheat on you. And therefore, those people, the vast bulk of humanity, are idiots, marks, from the carnival point of view. And that's the way what we would consider the worst members of society think we're really fantastic or too good. And then you take somebody from the middle. You say, what do you think of humanity? And almost all of those people will say, oh, we're pretty good. We all have our little faults, but they don't amount to anything. A little bit of cheating, a little bit of lying. Don't have to pay the taxes all the time. That kind of thing. But basically, we're pretty good people, everybody. And then you go to the top scientists and the top religious leaders and the philosophers, and what do they all say? Quite loudly. People need to be reformed. People are in a mess. They don't know what the heck they're doing. And, I'm going to give them this 10-step program, or I'll give them this, another approach. And so it looked to me immediately, if you step back from it, that everybody was seeing it from within their own perspective, and therefore they didn't have a good way of actually analyzing what was happening across the whole board. There's another reason for this, too. We'll go to Plato for a second. Plato tried to define truth and beauty and justice and love and happiness and so on. He spent a lot of time at it. And trying to define it. But actually, his mistake was pretty simple. Now, he's confused a lot of people over the thousands of years. He's inspired a lot of people, too, because what he did was, he's out over here. I'll just say that he was out over here. And he's looking ahead with his extraordinary imagination to start with and saying, where do I want to be in the future? Where do I want to go? What do I want to do? What would make me happy? Where would I feel comfortable? So he created the Republic, a society in which he'd feel comfortable and only about five other people, and therefore, he didn't have it. One of the other people would be Thomas More, who created Utopia. He'd be happy there too. So it's a society that is being projected by their own personality to say, if people were all like this, I'd be comfortable because actually everybody would be like me. That's basically what the emotional drive was behind the ideas. Now there's a lot of really interesting ideas in there. But it's not a good way to define anything because these are aspirational goals. Justice, love, truth, beauty. He's defining them in a way as it's an aspirational goal. Now, I don't blame him. I mean, these guys were the guys that got reason started on abstract things. Pythagoras, Plato, Socrates, Aristotle. They started to apply reasoning to very abstract things, trying to find patterns. Early scientists did the same thing in Greece. There isn't a lot of that experience at that time. So my analogy for it is a little bit like they were the first amphibians. They wandered out of the water. They were still soaking wet. They didn't know what they had invented, essentially. They didn't know that they'd invented living on land because they were going back in the water all the time. So in this case, they didn't know that they'd invented the concept. Plato called them eternal ideas, and they're shrouded in mystical ideas and aspirationally beautiful ideas, and they inspire a lot of people, but that's because they inspired Plato and people pick up on that emotion and go with it. But now that we've had the idea of a concept around for a really long time, we know that it's interesting as an aspirational goal. That's one way that you can use a concept. But what's really useful to us are when we discover the inherent pattern in reality. What's the inherent pattern in some form of reality? So if we find out that gravity is a certain rule in science and physical things, and you can write it as an equation, and you can say this is true all the time, under all circumstances, very extreme circumstances, but this is a true rule, that's very, very useful. It's not useful to inspire people, but it's useful to explain something. So let's forget about inspiring everybody and try to explain something and say, what is it that is common to all forms of love? Let's use our couple thousand years of experience and our familiarity with concepts and our familiarity with this approach to life and not be afraid of putting reason to the test, as the ancient Greeks were not afraid of putting reason to the test on anything. Now, why has it been so unpopular to apply reason to all these things? Because scientists, it's a mushy area for science. It's a mushy area to go into. People want to stick with what they really can stick to. They don't want to be embarrassed by going into an area that then they're proven wrong on or they really can't be tied down to. And in addition, that area is for religion, essentially, or mystics or something like that. But the fact is, if you're going to be really scientific, you have to face all forms of reality. And so let's get it started again. Let's start to apply reason to what's abstract in our lives. Because how many people think that emotions don't exist? Everybody knows they exist, okay? Everybody. And you can't prove it, but we all know that they're there. So I'm not going to go into saying whether they exist or not, but let's look at the analogy. Now, the next thing I think that we need to think about is that when we're trying to explain something, you can't say everything. You can't include all the details. Some people say, you know, that the best map is a duplicate of the object that you're mapping. But of course, that's not really that useful. You know, something that duplicates another object is not that useful. What's really useful is to show the lines, the clear delineations, the inherent pattern in what's going on, so that we can take those principles and apply them to daily life. So that's the approach that we're going to take. And so let's try to dip into reality here and see if we can't find out what are the elements of what we call love. So the first thing is, the first element that I determined was love is that it's an emotion. Kind of pretty obvious. But what are emotions? That's not so obvious. So what's the pattern behind emotions? What are they? Well, my definition for emotions is that they're the automatic mental responses of our minds to our experiences. They're automatic. We can't do anything about them. You can't change them directly. Because whatever happens, you react emotionally to it without pausing to think. So all emotions, including love, are an automatic mental response to our experiences. Now, it's interesting that something that abstract as an emotion and just something that's only going on in our own minds, by the way. So there's lots of other things, you know, love makes the world go round. There's all kinds of love is a warm puppy. So you know, these are all examples, but they are not, you know, the definition I'm looking for. So if love is an emotion and it only takes place in your own mind, then the question is it real? And this is what the scientists, if it only takes place in your own, in people's minds, it's not really real. We can't measure it. I'll just say that briefly. I think that's the great prejudice of scientists in the 20th century, is that only we can only know what we can measure. And it's because we're so successful at measuring things that we've gotten, you know, this is the most interesting way we go astray is when we have a really good idea that it applies really well in a large number of cases, and then we apply it where it ought not to be applied. Bad ideas are easily dismissed in time. Only takes a couple hundred years. But good ideas that have a lot of good effects that really are profoundly useful to us, it's very hard to tell when we've overdone it. Okay, so that's one. I'll predict, you know, 150 years from now, people say, why did they think you can only know what's measurable? But in any case, that's what has prevented us, I think, from going into this area. So, and now we have a nice part of our culture, which has made the opposite statement as well. You know, when you say that it only takes place in your own mind, that doesn't mean it isn't real. As Professor Dumbledore said to Harry Potter, And he said, just because it only takes place in your own mind, it doesn't mean it's not real. Now, let me give you an example. How many of you can feel other people's emotions? Now, I mean, you don't have to raise your hands, but I'm sure that who can't do that? No, if anybody raises their hand, they're a psychopath. I'm sorry. Because almost everybody else can feel other people's emotions. Yeah, right? And it's I have an analogy for it. And this analogy has been used by plenty of people about emotions. If emotions are like color, like colors, then your mind is like a prism. And every prism is slightly different. And you take something that's objective, like white light that's going through. One of my ideas is that almost everything physical is objective, and everything subjective is brought to it by our own minds. So in this case, your mind is a prism. Every prism is slightly different than other ones, and when you throw white light through it, it displays the emotions or displays the colors in slightly different ways. But we recognize those different emotions. There is a pattern. We recognize love in another person. We recognize love in another person, even when it's not directed at us. If you see somebody loving somebody else, you can feel that emotion. You can experience it. Right? And so we are aware of what's going on in other people's minds. In that case, we're all psychic. Because you know what's going on in other people's minds. You don't know the details, and I can actually make a suggestion that mostly you would not want to know the details. No? That if you had the capacity to know all the details that were going on in another person's mind, you would get tired of it very quickly. I mean, it's much better just to watch an old comedies on television or something than to actually watch what's going on in another person's mind. So, but we are completely aware, or not completely, but we are quite aware of other people's emotions. We feel them. You can walk into a room and say, someone in here is sad. I'm sure you've done that. Almost everybody's done that. Why is somebody sad? You know, if you walk into a funeral parlor and you feel that, that's one thing. If you walk into a classroom or you walk into something else, something in here is sad, you find out something sad just happened. Now, because it can't be measured, scientists are trying to say that that has to do with the way our hormones bubble through our system, and that if only you change your hormones or you change this or you change some chemical, that you will then experience something different. And it's actually true that if you start to give your body different inputs, you will feel differently about things. However, you know, I think it's so blind, almost blind, even though I really love scientific approaches to things, it's almost blind to say that the cause is some bubbling in your chemical bubbling in your body when you are sad because your mother just died. No, it's because your mother just died that you're sad, not because something's going on inside of you. Maybe because you're sad that your mother died, your body is starting to produce different chemicals, not to cause the sadness, but that's just what happens when you do it. I think cause and effect is probably turned around on that one, and they'll find that out a lot later after they realize that that's probably not the cause. Because they'll have all kinds of counterexamples, which is what convinces them. They'll have people who are sad who don't have those chemicals, and then they'll say, how come? Because those are the chemicals that cause sadness. Or that's the gene that causes this, and so on. You know, I find it fascinating that we have our minds and we have our wills and we make decisions, and the decisions are all being put on genes now. I mean, genes, what do they want it for? Why would the genes want all those things? It's a very, there's probably a blueprint in our system for all kinds of things. But our minds probably draw on that blueprint to make things happen, as opposed to the blueprint imposing on us our lives. Again, probably cause and effect. But to go back to love, we have these emotions. We can experience them in other people. We can feel them in other people. But there's an overreaction on both parts. If you take this human personality curve that I took on, we'll go back to the psychopaths for a second. What's the psychopath's problem? They can feel other minds. But what they only want to experience is fear. They don't want to experience any other emotion of the other person because that will affect their ability to behave towards them as objects. They want to feel their fear because that's what they enjoy. They enjoy creating fear in other minds. So they want to feel that person's fear, but probably the best way to confuse a psychopath is when they're trying to terrorize them, if you could possibly, you know, love them. They would not have any idea what you're up to. It would be very confusing. They might even walk away, but probably not, and don't try. Okay, but basically the problem there, and for other people that have emotional difficulties in dealing with other people, it is to cut off other people's emotions. Now, why does that happen? There's the other end, what we call empaths, people who feel other people's emotions so intently all the time. Now, what's wrong with that? A lot of people say that's wonderful. Well, the difficulty only comes in when you can't tell if it's their emotions or your emotions. That's a problem. Because you can sympathize with someone's sadness, for example, but, you know, it's not yours. And you can even feel sad for their sadness. That's what minds do with each other in a relationship. But it's not your sadness. And you can be much, much more useful as a friend if you don't fall that extra step. And you also feel always a little bit endangered and vulnerable when you think that other people's emotions are yours, especially when you absorb their opinions about you. No. And you begin to believe that that should be your opinion about yourself. That's a whole other topic, but I'll just drop it and say, you know, we'll go back to love. But that's also totally unnecessary. That's being aware of other people's thoughts. But it's not a good idea. Now, for example, right now, you know, there's about 75 of you here. If I was trying to process all of your opinions about me all at the same time and trying to say, yes, I'm like that, or yes, I'm like that, and try to adjust to everybody, of course, that wouldn't be very good. And that's actually the reason why a lot of people hate public speaking, because that's what's going on in an audience. And you, if you're at all empathic and worried about that, or you're at all subject to that process, it can scare you more than death does. As a matter of fact, there was a poll that 67% of the people were afraid of public speaking, and only 65% were afraid of death. So, I don't fall in that category, obviously. So, that's what's going on with love. Love is an emotion, a little bit about emotions. Now, what kind of an emotion is it? There's a lot of different emotions. What specific form of emotion is it? Well, the second element is that it's an attraction. It's an attraction. Love is a form of attraction, and the attraction is, you know, like we are drawn to be with people that we love. We're drawn to spend time with them. We're drawn to pay attention to them. We're drawn to it. There's an attraction. Okay? So the other element of love is that it's an attraction. It's an emotion caused by an attraction. What's it an attraction to? That's where the rub is. Okay? What are we being attracted to? We're being attracted to the promise of happiness. Okay? So there's a quality. There's a quality here, and that quality is, and we just experience it as a quality, something about somebody else, or about something. It can be about objects, it can be about people, but we think that there's the promise of happiness is going to come from this thing, and we feel that quality, and it's very unconscious. It's usually not, very few people can detail this out in their mind. It's an emotional reaction. That's why love is this emotional reaction. You don't think about it, but it's a very intelligent reaction. And that intelligence is saying, this is promising me happiness. Now, I'll talk about it later. This is, you know, if your desires are all chaotic and screwed up, you can be very confused about what will actually bring you happiness, but that's a totally different thing. The love itself, the automatic mental reaction, is that quality. Now, what quality? Now, I'm going to go off on a tangent here for a second. Concepts, when you're trying to... He's smiling like you've been doing that the entire time. But concepts, when you're trying to define concepts, there are a lot of ideas in our language. There's a lot of concepts that we use. Most of them are not defined very clearly. Most of them are vague and fuzzy around the edges. So when you come up with something new like this, it's kind of a little bit difficult to say, what is this a lot like? But this quality that promises us happiness is something that actually one concept that we use a lot fits right into, but it's, you know, it's not exactly how we use it. But I think that that's what we should call it. And that quality is beauty. Beauty is the thing, the quality that promises us happiness. That's why beauty is in the eye of the beholder, because it's what you think is going to promise you happiness. And that's what you think is beautiful. So those are the three elements. My definition of love is the emotion caused by the attraction to beauty. Okay? Now let's see if that definition applies to everything that we call love, or almost everything, so that it is a functional definition. Okay? So the first area that we can talk about is impersonal love. I have three different forms of love. There's lots of different forms of love. I won't even talk about platonic love because I don't want everyone to fall asleep. But impersonal love is when you love an object. For example, lots of teenagers, when I was a boy, and I'm sure that they're not that dissimilar now, loved their cars. know, their first car. I had a good friend who had a 1963 Chevy with a V8 327, and it was white. He loved that car. He also drove it way too fast. And he was extremely foolish because one of our streets, there was the street he lived on. It had a big valley that a river had gone through before. And it would go down like this, and then it came right up. And it was a pretty deep valley, almost like a San Francisco street. And he would, you know, come off of the red light over here, and he would floor it. He would go down, and he would come up so that he would, you know, loft himself. Now, that was only two blocks away from his parents' home. Well, it was right over there. But he would come up, boom, you know, and land. He would often hit 55, 60 miles an hour on a city street. I didn't drive with him too many times after he did it a couple of months. But there's a love for a car. Now, a lot of people say, you can't love a car. You can't love a car. But my definition and lots of experience says you can love a car. You know, because it is your attraction. It's an emotion, and it's your attraction to the promise of happiness. That car is the promise of happiness in lots of different ways to teenage boys, which I won't go into detail on. But their cars, those cars are really, you know, a symbol of love for them. I mean, they love them. But it's an object. It's not a person. It's an object. So I call it impersonal love. Now, people also love power, right? And why do people love power? They're attracted to power. They're attracted to the promise of happiness that power is going to give them. Because they think if they had power, people couldn't squash them so often. They could squash somebody else. Okay? And so you might want to squash somebody else, or you might want to just not get squashed, or you might 60% not want to get squashed and 40% want to squash others. Everybody has their own set of motives for what they love and why love happens. But it's your set of desires, because your desires are what you think is going to bring you happiness, right? And so what the promise of happiness has everything to do with your desires. Now people say, how could you love that ugly person, for example? And the other people will call it ugly, because ugliness and beauty are exactly the opposite. And for them, that doesn't promise happiness, that promises unhappiness, what's called ugly. Okay? But beauty is in the eye of the beholder, so is ugliness. That person who seems ugly may have a very kind personality, right? And that's what they're looking for in life. And maybe even they're very insecure, and they, you know, feel that if they're in this situation, they'll be safe in somehow. And so their decisions are very complex. Usually you have 100 motives for every desire, and you don't know how they influence that, but the motives are actually your real desires. That's a totally another topic, but that plays into why we all experience love differently and why we all love different things differently. But our culture tells us symmetry is beautiful, right? So we like symmetry. Our culture tells us that if you're a success in life, you will have this and you will have that, a big house or this or that. So you love the big house as a symbol of that you are one of the people that has succeeded in life. It may be that it's too much trouble. I was at a dinner 10 years ago or so. And it was in the Sheraton Palace Hotel, which is just up the road here. For those of you who have been in the ballroom, which is a very big ballroom with big crystal chandeliers and everything, we were in there talking. And one of the guys was talking about his neighbor out in Danville who had just asked for a zoning variance so that he could add a 4,000-square-foot playroom for his children to his 12,000-square-foot home. And, of course, Danville doesn't like big homes. So at 12,000 square feet, they wanted to cut it off. So now, that was what they said. Now, I looked around in that ballroom, and I said, you know, this ballroom is about 40 by 100 feet. It's about 4,000 square feet. That means this guy wants to add the ballroom at the Sheraton Palace Hotel to his home for a playroom for his kids. Was he going to put in there a racetrack? Right. And I also, he wasn't there, otherwise I would have gone to him and said, you know, if you can't lose your teenagers in 12,000 square feet, you won't lose them in 16,000. Just forget it. Just send them to boarding school. You know, and be done with it, you know. So it's cheaper than a 4,000 square foot playroom anyway. So, you know, it all depends on what you love, what your image is, what you think is going to produce this promise of happiness for you. And if you buy a large number of ideas that have been given to you by the culture, that's going to play into your thing of what you love. So impersonal love is about this. Now, you can also love people as objects, as lots of people say, you know, and that's been talked about a lot, so I won't go into great detail. But if you objectify the other person in your relationship, you like them for their money, you like them for other factors, you like them for that they're tall and you like tall, or you like them because they're short and you want to be taller than the person that you're in love with, or you like them because they're dumb because you want to be the more intelligent person in the relationship. There's a wide variety, all depending upon what you think is going to make you personally happy. This is one of the reasons why it's very hard to find the base elements of these emotions, because it's totally complicated by every individual's desires. But all I have to do is bring back to the element and say, yeah, it's an emotion. That's what every mind has. And then you can eliminate all those complications and come up with a pattern. So that's objective love. Another interesting form of this is jealousy. Jealousy is another form of impersonal love. And what's very fascinating about it is, what is it that you're loving? You're loving the ability to cause jealousy in other minds. There are lots of people who would rather date somebody who they don't like, but that makes everybody else turn their heads as they walk down the street, than actually date someone that they like. Which means, whatever their set of motives are, the motive of making other people jealous, thinking that he's having a good time or she's having a good time with their partner, is more important to them than actually having a good time. I'm sorry, but I just described a large number of people. And so it's fascinating, because what is the love there? The love in the relationship is the love, the enjoyment. The promise of happiness comes from, you know that this is going to make all kinds of people jealous of you, and that's what you love. Same thing can be done by the big house or by a Mercedes, or, you know, there's a lot of different ways to do this, or to win an award that everybody, you know, wants. I mean, if you're a professor, you don't do it that way. But if you can win the Nobel Prize, you have a feeling that your colleagues might just be a little bit jealous. And you know, if you're really a noble person before you win the Nobel Prize, it might just be 10% of your motive that to make your colleagues jealous. But if you're, you know, kind of run-of-the-mill professor, it could easily be 50, 60% of your motive for wanting to win that. Not to find out the truth that will actually, you know, win you the Nobel Prize, but just to inspire other people's jealousy of your intellect. So those are all forms of impersonal love. So what's personal love, then? Personal love is very interesting, because it's not that common, actually. But it's highly desirable, and people all want it. Personal love is when you, for example, find another personality to be beautiful. A personality, their mind. The way they live their lives, the what you feel from them as a person. You love them for that. Now, you know, in relationships with people, and between parents and children, for example, some parents love their children just because they're their children. Now, that's an objective, impersonal. I mean, say, I love my child, but I can't stand his personality. And then they wonder why, you know, the kid says, you know, I didn't feel that you loved me enough when they're 25 years old. Because, you know, she made it very clear that, you know, if you just change these five basic parts of your personality, like, you're interested in philosophy, let's get rid of that. Yeah. So, you know, those kind of things are fundamentally, by the way, my mother loved my interest in philosophy. That was just an example. The experience of these things, of personal love, is one person thinking the other person is beautiful. And it doesn't matter what their physical form is, it's the personality that they like. And now, it doesn't mean that it's beautiful to everybody. Some people, and some movie stars play into these roles, some people want a partner who's easy to hurt. Right? Don't want to go into all the elements of sadomasochism, but people want that. Some people want that. And therefore, when they see an extremely vulnerable person, I won't mention Marilyn Monroe, but, you know, if they see an extremely vulnerable person who's easy to hurt, then they find that very, very attractive. Some find it attractive because they want to protect that person in a paternalistic way against other people hurting. And other people are attracted because they think, if she wants to be hurt, I can hurt her, you know, and she will not complain too much. Right? So I don't mean, you know, to talk about love and then talk about all these, but this is all part of it. It's all part of it. I want to cover everything. In minor detail. Yeah? So that's another element of what's going on. And of course, that form is not personal love. That is a love for the part of the personality. You actually love their personality, but you don't love it because it's wonderful. You love it because you can get happiness out of it. Right? So that's not so much of a compliment. Right? But the other form of personal love is one of our favorite compliments. if not when we love somebody else, but when somebody loves us for our personality, we think that that's a good deal. You know, they think, well, you know, they think I'm beautiful, and of course I think I'm beautiful. And that's a very well-founded basis. We think of the other people's personalities as beautiful because they're sort of based on ours or what we like about our personality. And I'm not saying that ironically either, because it's your own personality which is your greatest work of art, essentially, and it's what makes you happy. Whatever happiness you experience, it's because of the decisions you make yourself. That's your personality doing it. So you should think of your personality as beautiful. You should think of other personalities like yours as beautiful. This is not a negative statement to make about it. Okay? But that's personal love. It's just between two minds. Morally, it's not just two minds. It can be three, four, five, six, seven. But it's about your personalities. And we find it very attractive when people love us. Because not only is it nice to have somebody love your personality, but it reinforces your own personal conclusion that you have a beautiful personality. Right? And so it's not only attractive in itself, but it also is reinforcing to a fundamental way that we look at things. So before we take questions, I'll get to the one thing that everybody wants to know about, which is true love. True love. What is true love? Well, it's not what you expect. And you ought not to expect it. But true love, as a farm boy said to the princess bride, it doesn't happen every day. What do you think? This is true love. It doesn't happen every day. But the reason it doesn't happen every day is because it's the two forms of personal love I just talked about at the same time. That a person finds somebody else's personality beautiful, and that same person thinks that your personality is beautiful. Both at the same time. That's what true love is. It's pretty simple. And it happens quite often, actually. But, you know, we kind of want it to be 100%. It's never 100%. If you've got 80% going on good in a relationship, you know, you should just accept the other 20% because you're doing really well. It's one of the basic principles of friendship is that, you know, because trying to get it to 100%, that's your image of what you want that other person to be, not who that other person is. So you're not really being personal. You're objective. It's impersonal love. You're in love with the image you have of the other person, not the other person. And they're always knocking. They're going, you know, that's not who I really am. That's not who I really am. And one day after 25 years, you're saying, hey, you're not the person that I thought I loved all these 25 years. Well, I've been trying to tell you, you know. That's the interesting part of a relationship. People want love so badly that you can keep an illusion going for a long time. But the thing that's really stable about long-term friendships, it doesn't have to be a sexual romantic relationship, any long-term relationship, friendships that last really long periods of time, it's usually that both people like the other person's personality. They find it very attractive and it promises them happiness. They like to spend time with that person. They like to spend attention on that person. That's what true love is in all of its forms. So that's what I have to say about what love is and what a rational explanation of love. And if there are any questions, if anybody wants to bring up examples that don't fit the pattern, I'd be happy to talk about that, but you can talk about anything else. And while we're doing that, during the question and answer period, love, of course, is only one of the emotions. I have here the basic principles of our personalities, of all of our personalities, all the emotions and what the definitions are, what the patterns are. So if anybody wants to take a look at that, ask any questions about that. But first we'll take questions on love. So,
thank you.
Sure. Just pass it out. You can just pass them around. So for questions, we need to use the mic because it's being recorded for our radio and online audiences. So would you like to start?
There's many dynamics in life, you know, self and family, and some of them you didn't mention, you know, love of other life forms, like
right.
Plants and animals, God or something like
right.
that, the physical universe.
Physical universe, right.
Mankind.
Okay. Good. Yeah. They're all, yeah. These are all forms of love. Absolutely. And, you know, there are people who hate all of those things as well. Now, hatred, as you'll see from the definition I just passed out is similar to love. It's the emotion caused by the repulsion from ugliness. That is, you feel an ugliness is just like beauty in that it's ugliness is what promises you unhappiness. Okay? So now if you have been taught a certain way to think about life, or to think about God, for example, if you're taught a certain way to think about God, that he will punish you if you behave a certain way, and you've been behaving that way for 35 years, all you can expect is unhappiness from him. Right? And so you will hate him. Or you might love him for 60 years in a row and think you're the apple of his eye. And then your husband dies or your spouse dies and or your partner dies. And then you say, how could you do this to me? And then you hate him because you have caused me so much unhappiness. You shouldn't have done that. What did I do? So love and hate, you know, you can do it at the same time. Love can turn into hate just like that because something in your perception was off or something in the perception changes. It's based on your perception. That's why these emotions are automatic and why you can be totally in love with somebody for 45 years and they come home and they, you know, even you don't want to admit it, but they now have Alzheimer's and they've been so difficult to deal with that you find yourself hating them a little bit. Not a lot, but a little bit, because they're causing you so much unhappiness on top of all the love that was there. Or, this is a terrible end to our love story. You can also say that. And it takes a very, very unique individual to not have any of that inside them, so I wouldn't worry about it. But sometimes it overwhelms the whole situation and people leave. I've known plenty of good people who've walked out on those situations. They just can't deal with the turning something so beautiful into something so it's an understandable reaction, but our society, of course, wants you to stay there to the end, and there's a good reason for that, too. Because if you stay there to the end, what are you saying? You're saying that personality is what I love, not what everybody else sees, not, you know, all the other things that are involved. And so we admire this greatly because it fits into the true love, personal love thing, and that's what we admire most in life, in other people. Not most in life, maybe, but it gets close. To one of the most valuable things in life, and that's why we hold it so dearly.
And I think a very, very important point is that philosophers and many people find very true is that if you hate others or other aspects or dynamics of life, you're not loving yourself. It hurts you actually to hate or resent others.
I have a slightly different take on that. I understand that. My take is very simple. Ugliness is the promise of unhappiness, right? That's what I just called it. It's a promise of unhappiness. What if you looked at life in a way that nothing could cause you unhappiness? Then you will not give that power to anything else, and you will not hate anything else. It's the way of looking at other things that gives them the power to cause you unhappiness. That's a very, very long explanation I won't go into. But you know, I've written about it and so on, and I think that that's what's behind this, they're absolutely right in saying that it discolors you. It leaves you in a less powerful position to hate something else or to be angry. For example, to be angry, anger I've defined as the rejection, the emotion caused by the rejection of reality. Okay, that's what it is. Patience is the acceptance of reality. But the fact is, we all reject a little pieces of reality on a regular basis. And it doesn't really cause any great distress. But what causes great distress is really, really not liking reality in a big way. Now, you talked about the love of the universe, and you know there's a group of Buddhist theory that you should love all beings in the universe. Now, I think that's an interesting idea. You can say, for example, what do all the beings in the universe, how do they promise you happiness? Well, they promise you happiness in just a very vague way. That is, they exist. You're happy you're not alone in the universe, right? And so in that sense, you can have a vague friendliness, love to every being in the universe and say, I'm glad there's lots of other minds around because, first of all, you know, I don't want to do that job. It's good that there's all kinds of other people out there doing other things. It's good that there are animals out there. You might like particular kinds of animals and not others. A very interesting thing about our society is that we like wolves and we like eagles. And we like lions. They're noble. We say they're noble, and there's an attraction to these. What are we attracted by? They're all predators who get their way over other people. That shows that that's what we what would make us happy inside, is if we could be those predators and not have any guilt. Not we could erase all of the religious ideas that of our culture and be like them and just go out there and do what we want to do. That's why those animals are admired. How's that for an explanation?
George, expanding on your relationship between persons and the extent to which appreciating, I think is a wonderful term, appreciating the personalities of the other person is so important. And there's another point that I think needs to be added, and I'm sure you assume this, that in the process, when you have a very close friendship with a person, and it's a loving relationship, quite frequently you want to grant as much freedom as possible to that person in order to give them the unlimited space to express their personality, mm-hmm. which you appreciate and love so much.
Mm-hmm.
So along with the mutual understanding of each other's qualitative personality, there's that act of respecting each other's liberty and freedom. And along with that, you have this other wonderful quality. When you get very, very close to another individual, whether it's whether in a marriage with a child or with a wife or with a friend, also you respect a certain unknowable mystery about the other person.
Mm-hmm.
You appreciate that too.
Right.
That somehow that's an integral part of their unique personality, which inspires both of you.
Yeah. Yeah, we can, even though we don't know ourselves completely, we can learn, you know, it's helpful to have other people we respect and admire and appreciate because we can learn something from them that then helps us something about ourselves. And I can tell you're a baby boomer because, you know, that was a big baby boom idea. You know, if you love something, you let it free and let it go. But but that's a little different than what you're saying. But yes, people often want to confine somebody who they love and who's in a loving relationship. And the reason for it is because they don't want to lose it.
Yeah,
right? Because they're afraid of losing it. But it's the fear that's making the confining. What you really want is for them to be totally free and to love you. Right? But you're not so sure that that's going to happen. yeah. So there's a fight going on there. But theoretically, absolutely. And to come back to your question just a little bit, you know, this feeling of love, you know, and this idea that you have to love everybody with the same intensity that you love yourself, I think is unfortunate. Because you can't love the whole universe as you love yourself. It does a lot of things to you you don't like. You know, a lot of things happen which you don't like. I think it's sufficient to have a generally friendly attitude to the existence of all the other minds and to not overdo it in destroying their habitat and all and make some kind of deal with them about living together and so on. There's a lot of ways, but you don't have to say, you know, I love cows so much that I would like to talk to one all day long. No. There are very few people you'd like to talk to all day long. So, and if you were a mind reader, I don't think reading the mind of the cow all day long would probably be that interesting. But, you know, there's a relationship with animals that's very, very clear. You know, that we have these rules, which I've just laid out, I think apply to all the minds that exist, including all the animal minds. I think they have exactly the same principles that guide their minds as well. And I think that's why when a horse runs so well, that we kind of get excited. Because you can feel that horse wanting to win. You can feel it. And, you know, they look beautiful when they run. You know, no human being runs as beautifully as a horse does. We can kind of feel the inadequacy of two legs when you watch a horse run. So, and there was an interesting comment that I heard not too long ago after because of the Triple Crown things. I find it very interesting, he said, that the owners and trainers and everybody agreed that because I'll have another, whatever the name, had a possible sprained leg, that they didn't let him win, didn't let him run, right? Because he could get more injured. Okay? Now, there might be financial reasons for that, but everybody agreed about that for the horse. They didn't want the horse to be hurt. Says, I compare that to sending our kids to play football in high school, you know, and they get injured, and what do? We do whatever we can to get them back out there on the field again right away. We don't take them out of the game. I don't find that an interest. You know, he said somehow, why do we do that? Yeah. So, yes.
So if I understand correctly, with love, it's a reciprocal appreciation of personality that leads to happiness.
Well, true love.
True love, right.
Yeah, it's just one form of love, one of the more rare ones. Yeah.
So that, by definition, that means it is changeable and fluid, right?
Because fluid, absolutely.
Because someone's personality can change, and so true love really can be a fleeting thing.
Absolutely.
It's not permanent.
Yeah, and as a matter of fact, the idea that any love is eternal is assuming that love is some kind of objective thing out there and so on. Love is never eternal. Love is in your own mind, and it's based on your desires, and so it only lasts as long as you think the way you do about certain things. Yeah? So that's what's interesting about it is, see, and all emotions, to go to the all emotions for a second, we cannot change our emotions directly, but we can change them intellectually by changing our desires. Because as you change your desires, your emotions automatically go along with them. A good example is, so you're a little girl and you have dolls and you love playing with your dolls. I mean, you literally love playing. That gives you a lot of happiness. You love playing with your dolls. And you have a younger brother. And the younger brother comes in one time when you're playing with some of your friends and rips the heads off of all your dolls and then runs away. Right? It's happened to almost everybody in the audience, right? Okay. So you not only hate your little brother, but there's a lot of things. But you experience this whole range of emotions a certain way. And now you're 12 years old, and you've put away your dolls because it's embarrassing. You still like them a little bit, but you know you put them away and you don't show them to your friends very often. Oh, you got the heads back. And your brother comes along, and he's still being obnoxious and is trying to give you a hard time. And he comes into your collection, and you come back someday, and you find all the heads are gone again. Okay? Now, you are angry at your brother for being such a squirt, or something like that. But it's not the same emotional reaction, because it doesn't mean the same thing to you anymore, right? Now you're a 25-year-old mom, or 30-year-old mom, and you have a little daughter and a little son, and you watch your daughter playing with the dolls, and you think it's so wonderful, and you've given her even some of your old dolls, but she doesn't like those, which irritates you a little bit. She likes something that's new and popular. And so she's playing with those dolls, and then you watch your little son come in and rip off all the heads and throw them away. And so you have another reaction to the same experience, which is complicated by a large number of other factors. Okay, so you see the same thing, dolls being heads being ripped off, and each time it's a different thing, because each time it's in a different context. And that's why, you know, true love or personal love or even vague, even the higher forms of impersonal love in a relationship keep shifting over time. And people who've been married 35 years and are still in love with each other say it's better now than it's ever been before, because it just keeps, if it keeps up for that long, you keep hitting deeper and deeper levels of appreciation of the other person. Yeah, exactly. By contract. Just a second.
I have a question about the personality, your definition.
Uh-huh.
I want to know if you're thinking, is personality, when you said you find beauty or love in it, is it soul and heart and mind and the physical being? Mm-hmm. I'd like to hear what you have to say about that.
Ah, okay. It's a very difficult subject because everybody has different ideas. As I said, you know, when you go into an area and there's all these concepts out there, just like with beauty, they all overlap and they all have different definitions and so on. And I'll go back to the Buddhists for a second. They say that, you know, you are your Atman, and then you're really truly Brahman inside, and beneath that is something else, so that you can get back to the universal mind, and that's all part of you. That's one depth psychology approach. And then we have all of our different parts, you know, Plato divided into three, Freud divided into three, your mind, and so on. Okay, so I've decided to use the word personality or mind to cover who we really are. To me, every mind, every personality is a decision maker. Anything that makes decisions is a mind. Anything that doesn't make decisions is not a mind. That is the dividing line. And so, to me, you know, if you talk about loving plants, for example, doesn't seem to me like plants make any decisions. You know, they just move with the sun. They're very fancy biological plants. I could be wrong. They don't seem to make, and it would be kind of boring to just sit in one place the whole time, so maybe they can get along without minds. I mean, they don't have minds. Okay? They're not aware of things. But all animals make decisions, even if they're the simplest things. You know, the ant starts walking this way, then it goes the other way, then it goes the other way. Maybe it doesn't know what it's doing, but it's making one decision after another with, you know, mindlessly. I mean, you can watch that in New York City from up above and watch everybody squirrel around. It looks pretty much the same. So I think, you know, the dividing line is decision maker. And I just call it mind or personality, and I think it doesn't make any difference, all the other things, whether it's the soul or whether it's this or not. I have a whole other thing about whether that mind lasts longer than our bodies do or doesn't. But I do think that the argument is not that necessary. It's not important for understanding ourselves. And it's not, you know, because either you die or you don't die, but, you know, if you die, you're not there anymore, and so you can't be unhappy about it. Right? You might be unhappy leading up to it because it's painful, but if when you die, you're gone, that's it. You're not unhappy about it. You're not thrilled. If you wanted to die, you're not thrilled that you're dead either. So, you know, no matter what you think about death, you're just not there to experience it if that's what it is. And if you don't die, you're bound to be exactly the same personality that you were before you died. And so if you like your personality, no problem either. If you don't like your personality, it's a good time now to do something about it. Because you're going to be living with yourself either until you die or forever, whichever one it is. Or 100,000 years, who knows? I think it's something we can't answer. But I do think that minds are clearly something different than matter. They're decision makers. And so where that comes down, I have a lot of ideas about, but again, not for tonight. But it's a very fundamental thing. And so I think, to go back to people, mystics and people who've gone inside and seen great flashes of light and identify with the whole universe, I think they're not used to their own mind. And so they exaggerate its importance when they see it. When they see their own mind in a deep state of meditation, or when they see their own mind in some other way, then that's only their own mind. That's what's been making all the decisions. And it looks less boundaries, there's no boundaries or whatever. But I think when you first experience it, you feel it to be much bigger than it actually is. It is limited, but it's so much more comfortable than not being in your own mind, because that's who you are. So that's all I'll say about that one. But I don't care what it's called. I think we're all minds. We make decisions. That's all. It's good enough for me. It's good enough for the ant. Any other questions? I'll go back to you for this time.
I'm just curious in terms of what you think in terms of contrasting romantic love mm-hmm. with true love, mm-hmm. and how would you actually judge what portion of a romantic love is actually true love, mm-hmm. and if there are notions, you know, in terms of media, other things that influence what we think of romantic love, and how we should shift our desires to be more realistic.
Yeah. Well, the first thing I'd say about that is, yes, the movies tell us that we should walk off into the sunset together. I'm not sure the sunsets are nice, but I don't really think that that's crucial. Yes, a romantic love is, of course, based on big thing. You know, people have said, why does this drive so much of life? Well, it's very, very clear, I think, to anybody who's in their 60s or 70s, why this drives so much of life. First, there's the period of time when you're a teenager in your early 20s when the sexual part of it is a huge attraction. That's a big part of your happiness. But it also is what leads to children, which is another big chunk of the happiness. And it also can lead to personal love, which is another big thing which we really love, you know, to experience, because that's so satisfying to us personally to have somebody else find us a source of happiness. We like that so much that people volunteer, you know, for food banks and all kinds of events and so on, because they know that when they go out and they do something for somebody else under those circumstances, those people are going to love them. Soldiers who are willing to die for their country, who are willing to die for everyone else is telling them, this is a wonderful thing to do for us. And so in their own minds, they're saying, yes, I'm doing a wonderful thing for everybody else. That makes me happy. That makes me happy. That's why it's so crucial that we don't use that, not illusion, but that reality, for anything other than what's absolutely crucial for it to be used for. Because we're really manipulating somebody into telling them, give up your life, you know, for just whatever. Yeah? So it's important that it be important when we do that. But romantic love, I think, when I said before, I think for every desire, there's usually 100 motives or more motives than that. And so in this romantic thing, the desire for sexual pleasure, for example, may be 60%, and the romantic part of it, the more personal thing, might be 40%. Everybody has a different prism of all these things. But as time goes on, it shifts and shifts. And after you have children, it has to shift, whether you want it to or not. You know, and so people keep shifting. And this is why there's, you know, these midlife crises that you know, are so popular. It's because people say, I want to get back the passion that I had when I was young. What was that passion for? It doesn't make any difference. You know, some older people want to hang out with younger people, even without any sex involved, just to feel the passion of the younger people, because it reminds them of that drive. Now, I've defined passion on my list. Passion is the emotion caused by the anticipation of happiness. But in expecting happiness to come out of something, you still probably don't have a lot of experience of it. Right? So at the beginning of your sexual life, there's so much more to explore, and there's so much more to find out in a relationship with other people, that the good parts make you passionate about finding more and more and more and more. And when you're 40 years old, you've gone through a long road, and for some, it has not been that happy a road. The passion is going to be less, unless you're a very unusual person. And so other things take over, and sometimes fear takes over more. Fear takes over more as a motive over time. And then suddenly people wake up and they're 43 and say, I'm being dominated by my fears. I don't like that. I want to be dominated by my passions. So they only know one way of doing that. The last time I was passionate, I was 23 years old. So they go to Las Vegas, you know. So the answer is, you know, everybody probably has some true love in their lives. Not a big, even maybe not a big chunk, but some. And oftentimes it's a non-sexual relationship, like a parent-child relationship, or even a teacher-student relationship where there isn't any sex involved. So, Because there's, you know, there is, sorry, the headlines sometimes interfere. because there's an enormous amount of trust in those relationships. And the trust comes because you know you're being loved just for your personality, just because you're there, and not for something else. And that's why it's so attractive and why people want a big portion of that in their lives as well. So there's nothing wrong with sex, but it does make people wonder whether that's the reason why. Just as much as if you have a ton of money, and you wonder, do people love me just because I have a lot of money? Now, if you're a good judge of character, you should be able to tell what percentage. You can't dismiss everybody who likes your money a little bit, you know. But if that's their overriding concern, then, you know, you should say, okay, you can keep them at arm's length, and that's just fine. But I don't mean to dismiss any of these things, because all forms of love are actually, you know, attractive to us. We're loved for all different reasons, and that's all fine. It's the proportion that really drives us crazy if it's out of proportion to what we want in the other person. Yeah.
The term unconditional love, is that synonymous with true love? Because I'm thinking of the situation where, like, a spouse may not have the same personality because of illness.
Right.
And you still love that person regardless. You love them because of who they are.
Right.
You know, it's a different thing.
Yeah. Unconditional love is pretty much the same thing as true love. I don't believe it's really truly unconditional ever. But I do think that that's what people hope for, aim for, think that that would be a great thing. And for good reason, because that just basically means the fact that you are alive and in that person's life. You know, but now, those of us who have a lot of friends or have had parents in old age, you know, a lot of people look forward to old age. I'm one of 12 children. So my parents, let's say, there's just time for this. One of my father's friends, when my dad was 65, asked him, and one of my youngest brothers, who was 12 years old at the time, was standing next to my father, and his friend asked him, Gene, what were you thinking of? You must have been out of your mind to have 12 children. I mean, what were you thinking of? And my dad said, well, you know, I'm 65 now, and my plan is starting to kick in. I'm going to retire very soon, and I'm going to sell my house, and I'm going to live 1 month with each of my children. And my 12-year-old brother immediately said, I'll take February. He went on to Princeton. But I think that, you know, the way that people imagine being taken care of in old age by their children and the reality of grandchildren is also a lot different. It's a great source of pleasure. But when you are tired and ill, you know, having guests come for a week or a month at a time is not a pleasure. not a pleasure. So I think being realistic about these things, and with your parents, and, you know, with your grandparents, depending upon your age and stuff like that, is also, you know, what they want is for you to think that they're an important part of your life, that you love them, that they gave you something, but they don't. You don't need to be there all the time to make that clear. Yeah. So there's unconditional love, and sometimes people say, you know, one last thing before the time runs out altogether. You know, a lot of times we desperately think that we cannot live for 1 second without those we love. You cannot be away from them. You can't not be with them. And there's a sort of desperation. That is a fear. That's not love. That's a fear. And I can tell you it doesn't ever happen, because every night you go to sleep and you leave them for 8 hours or 7 hours and they're gone. You know, they might show up in your dreams occasionally, but they're gone as far as you're concerned. And that's what life is like. You really can live without them. It's the pleasure of living with them. That's the wonderful thing. Thank you very much. All right, just a second. And that ends another event at the Commonwealth Club in its 109th year of existence.